We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. On February 11th, Hosni Mubarak gave up the presidency of Egypt. Almost 3 weeks of popular protest brought an end to his decades-long rule. Control of the government passed to the military, with promise on their part that free elections would be held and the country's 30-year-old emergency law would be lifted. This morning, we'll try to review some recent events in Egypt, look a little bit ahead to the future of the country. And certainly at least what might be expected to happen within the next few months. And our guest for the program is Ken Cuno. He's professor of history here at the University of Illinois and spends a lot of his time looking at and following contemporary Egyptian politics, and has been with us before on the program. In fact, he was here just the day before Hosni Mubarak stepped down. We missed it by one day. We were pleased, though, that he could come back and spend some more time with us and talk about this issue as it continues to develop. In addition, of course, as usual, people who are listening, you're welcome to call with questions, and he'll do his best to give you a response. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email, so if you'd like to send in a question that way, you can do that. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Any point here, people are welcome to call. We just hope folks will be brief, be on target with their questions. We get in as many as we can. And thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me, Ken.
For being here. As a question to start off, can you talk a little bit about who it is now that is running Egypt?
Who's in charge?
In charge?
Yeah. It's an odd situation because it's all sort of extra-constitutional. But basically, I guess what we could call the transitional government is headed by, or authority is vested in, this council called the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which is headed by Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, who's 75 years old, who is a longstanding colleague, I guess you could say, and loyalist of the former president, Hosni Mubarak. He was appointed, in addition to being a field marshal of the army, he was appointed defense minister in 1991. So he's the longest serving member of the cabinet at present in the country. This council, the Supreme Council, was, as far as I can tell, was cobbled together at the last minute to sort of take charge. It's not something, a constitutional body that has pre-existed, or it's not an organization that pre-existed the revolution. But vesting power in them was also a way of marginalizing or shoving aside Omar Suleiman, who was the vice president that Mubarak appointed during the revolutionary crisis. I don't know. I've not seen anywhere a list of all the names or the profiles of the people on this council. The pictures one sees on the news looks like maybe a dozen uniformed men sitting around, probably, I presume, representing all branches of the military. The Navy isn't terribly important to Egypt. It's mainly the Army and the Air Force that are important. So we just have a couple of names. But again, these are career officers, senior in age and rank. Then you've got the cabinet, and the relationship between the two isn't clear in constitutional terms because, again, this is an extra-constitutional situation. But Tantawi also has a seat in the cabinet as the defense minister, as I just mentioned. You have a prime minister that was appointed during the crisis, Ahmed Shafiq, another military man, a long time in the service of the Mubarak government, that was appointed during the crisis. So it seems that the Supreme Council is making the decisions and calling the shots up to now. They've made kind of the executive decisions as, okay, this is the next step we're going to take and then the next step after that. Whereas the cabinet, as far as I can tell, is kind of keeping things running as they have been, sort of like the below policy level operations. And not making any new departures, decisions that represent new departures. The other aspect of the cabinet to notice is that In the last week to week and a half, a lot of new faces have appeared. There's been a huge turnover. It's a very, very large cabinet, if you go to Wikipedia and look at the entry there. But the key, what you might call the core key portfolios in the cabinet that have to do with sort of running the state have remained in the hands of Mubarak loyalists. Defense Ministry Tantawi, the foreign minister who was appointed in 2004, Ahmed Abul Ghait, is still there. The Interior Minister was changed during the crisis. It's now another army general is in charge. It was appointed just in the past couple of weeks. New Justice Minister also appointed. The former Interior and Justice Ministers, I think, have been detained or at least put under house arrest. So those central four portfolios still are old regime people, two of them very old faces. So that's the situation, and how the Supreme Council seems to have met with representatives of the demonstrators only a handful of times, and they've including a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they've snubbed El Baradei and some other people. So it's still they certainly haven't formed a so-called national unity government or coalition that the protesters had been calling for. And this may be one thing that will be pushed for in the Friday demonstrations that are now being called for by the protest organizers.
Yeah. Well, so in looking again at the cabinets, on the one hand that you have the core ministries are still Mubarak appointees. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you do have some new appointments to the cabinet that are representatives or at least people who are involved in some of the country's opposition parties to the extent that there are such a thing. Two of them are Coptic Christians. One of the people that I've read about is in fact one of these two Coptic Christians who is the was named to be the Minister of Tourism, that makes it sound as if that's significant. These appointments are significant, at least in this respect. That if Mubarak was still running the country, that never would have happened. That people from other than his party are part of the cabinet. So one wonders, you know, on the one hand, if the most important members still are Mubarak appointees, how important is it that you do have these other people that in the past, under the old regime, never would have been in the government like that?
Yeah, I want to clarify. The Minister of Tourism, Munir Abdunur, who is a Copt. Actually, I hadn't realized that, so thanks for telling me that. But it isn't the case that Mubarak would not have appointed a Copt. It's that he would not have appointed a member of an opposition party.
Okay.
Because he does, I mean, he did play the politics of symbolism and playing to the idea of national unity, which in Egypt is code for Christian-Muslim amity, in that way, appointing Copts to the appointive seats in the National Assembly, as well as to some portfolios. I'm sure that some portfolios in the cabinet did have Coptic members. But Abdunur is Secretary General of the Waft Party, which is the largest legal party to have come into existence. Actually, it was sort of resurrected in 1978 when late President Sadat devolved to a more multi-party system. The Waft Party was the most popular party before 1952 during the monarchy period. And it's probably the only party that anybody up until now had given a chance to gain more popularity against the government. So, yeah, he's been brought in. Somebody from the leftist Tagama party, which is kind of the social democratic to Marxist party, not a very large party, but intellectually a powerhouse. He's been appointed Minister of Social Solidarity and Social Justice. And so a glass half full perspective would be these are gestures of inclusiveness, and they're moving in the right direction, given the fact that these are military people. I mean, the shots are being called by these crusty old generals, and they aren't experienced with being democratic or reaching out or being accountable to anybody except their superiors. So glass half full means they're making an effort and maybe they're moving in the right direction. Glass half empty perspective would be that these two opposition parties in particular, even though they've been really not a factor in politics. They have been fairly close to the old Mubarak regime and have gone along with a lot of stuff. They are not allies, have not, as secular parties, they've not been allies of the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. So they are the least outside of the outsiders, or the closest in of the outsiders, I guess you could say. Also, a minister of labor, a new minister of labor was appointed. And you know that there have been a couple of weeks of major strikes. There still are ongoing strikes, both organized and wildcat in the country. And this fellow is the former treasurer of the General Union for Workers Syndicates in Egypt, which, of course, is a regime-controlled. So he was a regime man. The independent unions in Egypt, which are now speaking up, are not very happy with this appointment. So it's not clear exactly what – if they're trying to send a signal, it's not really clear what they're trying to send. But they certainly aren't including the people who actually carried out the revolution.
We're talking in this hour of focus about recent events in Egypt, and our guest is Ken Cuno. He's professor of history here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and has been with us before on the program to talk about Egypt. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'd like to have you talk some more about the military. It certainly seems that the key here to what happened was the decision by the military to withdraw its support from Mr. Mubarak. So the question is, why?
Why did they? I guess you could say President Mubarak had become a liability. The military, as a lot of commentators have said, is a major institution. It's more than just a military. In fact, the title of the Minister of Defense is actually Defense and Military Production, Minister of Defense and Military Production. So military production covers this array of companies that the military have formed over the past 30 to 40 years, not only to produce weapons — they do control weapons-producing factories — but also civilian, you know, consumer durables like refrigerators. They've got a construction company that builds apartments, housing estates, a lot of which are for the officers class themselves, and so forth and so on. So they're a major employer. They're a major part of the public sector in the country. The full dimensions of their business enterprises, I've never seen a full accounting of that, because they aren't very public about it and they don't want people to know very much about it. So it's been estimated as representing anywhere from 4% to 10% of the GDP of the country and that sort of thing, which gives you a sense of like how little we know about what they're up to. So they had a lot to lose. They had a great deal to lose. The other thing is that the protest organizers recognized, I think, that this is where the power lays. This is kind of what some people call the deep state. This is the part of the iceberg that's below the water. And that by appealing to them with their slogans of, you know, the military and the people are one and this sort of thing, and playing up the genuinely heartfelt patriotism that people feel and identify with the army, and it's a citizen army because there's still conscription, all of that, that they were hoping, their strategy was to separate the military from the regime, or at least the top of the regime itself. But the situation we're in now is that, okay, having in a sense toppled or decapitated the regime, you still have the regime because you've aligned yourself, the protesters have aligned themselves with, and in a sense said to the army, take power, please, because we want to get rid of this guy and his corrupt, you know, government. They've done that, but they were the government to begin with, or they were a good part of the government to begin with, and they certainly were the force, the main pillar of the state holding it up. Now, there are other forces, or I guess you could say interests like the business classes and others, that have also been important in supporting the state and that will support the new order, provided, whether it's democratic or not, provided that it provides stability in an environment where business can be conducted and so forth. But they don't have the weapons. They don't have the power. So this is why we're in this kind of neither nor situation at the moment. We have a transition to something, and we're not sure. But part of the paradox here is that the people who are actually in charge are authoritarians, at least in their mindset. They're military men, and they're not military men like we're accustomed to here, who sort of, you know, if you talk to an American military officer, no matter how conservative they are or hawkish they are, the idea of civilian control is absolutely sacred to them. Many of them, like Colin Powell, I believe, didn't even vote until leaving the military, because that's part of the culture. We're just not involved in politics. This is a different kind of situation, and we'll have to see what happens. But it's going to be kind of a tug of war, I think, between the protesters and the other forces wanting to push the envelope on democracy versus these fellows who want to see order.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I read suggested that part of the motivation of the military was the recognition that Hosni Mubarak, and we have had some, I think, reports just after he stepped down, or maybe about the time that he stepped down, that his health was not good. So in the military, they would have to know that Mr. Mubarak was not going to be around forever. And would it certainly seemed that Mr. Mubarak was grooming his son to take over, and that maybe within the military they weren't real happy about the idea of that being the transition and having Mubarak's son being the next president.
Well, certainly that's something we were hearing going back a few years when the grooming became apparent. And the Egyptians had a very amusing, they coined a new term, which is a combination of monarchy and republic, because Egypt is constitutionally a republic, which is Jumhuriya in Egyptian Arabic. Monarchy is mamlakia, so they coined this new word gumlukia, meaning republarchy, to refer to what the Mubarak regime was putting in place. Right. It was actually in observing what had gone on in Syria, where the son of Hafez al-Assad succeeded him. That's where gumlukia or republarchy became a term that Egyptians were using. And it was expected the fix was in. But at the time, going back a few years, we heard that the military preferred Omar Suleiman because he's one of us, i.e. one of them, military men, because Gamal has an MBA from the American University in Cairo. He has a lot of business friends, but he's not from the military. So there was that. Yeah, I think they were a little bit concerned about being shoved aside. But part of it also had to do, and some of what's been coming out since the revolution is the split between Gamal and his circles in the military also had to do with the military's economic enterprises. That Gamal and many of those around him were among the beneficiaries of privatization, which in a medium-sized country without a huge capitalist or diverse capitalist class, as has happened in a number of other countries where this has been done in the past, for example, in, say, the Philippines, you get this phenomenon of crony capitalism where, to satisfy the Americans or the IMF, you sell off these state-owned concerns. But guess what? Sometimes it's the same person who was running it as a member of the military who now comes back in wearing civilian clothes as the owner of this enterprise, or one of the cronies of Gamal. So this has also been a source of resentment, public resentment, because these guys have been public, and that's fueled the revolution. But this question of who runs these enterprises is another factor. There's been more discussion of the split since Gamal left.
Well, you know, as one thinks about what's likely to happen and how things might change, and you look at the way that how heavily invested the military is in the country's economy, you wonder, would they be amenable to perhaps some kind of political change as long as the economic system of the country really didn't change, assuming that you could actually keep those two things separate?
Yeah, I think that these separate plates can be spun, to use that metaphor, for some time to come. And I think part of that also depends upon the Americans, the stance that they adopt, because as I have mentioned before, the last time we were here, the Americans and the IMF, World Bank, basically controlled by Americans, have been pushing for a very long time since the 1970s for privatization, structural readjustment, as they call it, as we have done in other parts of the world. This idea that you've got to let the market rip, you've got to have complete free trade and minimal government intervention in the economy and so forth and so on. And not just the military, but others as well. There were, you know, millions of people who still work for the public, these public sector concerns, either run by the military or not run by the military. So there's a huge interest in the country in not dismantling or not dismantling these public-owned companies very quickly. There's also a huge interest in maintaining at least some level the subsidies of basic commodities. And just recently, one of the pronouncements from the cabinet, which has just begun, I think it just began meeting yesterday, was that they were going to look at the subsidies, maintaining the subsidies. And again, these are things that for a country where 20% or more are below the poverty line as defined there in their terms, and another 20% are just above the poverty line, having some basic subsidy of bread and flour and gasoline and things like this is extremely important. It would be the equivalent of the child tax credit that we have, except spread across, you know, the country. So, I mean, I'm mentioning that specifically to say that, look, you know, there are different ways of subsidizing people who need a little extra cash during the year, and that's the way that they've done it traditionally. But they've been under pressure from the Americans and other donor nations to do away with these subsidies for a very, very long time. So it's not just the military necessarily. But the military, especially the senior ranks of the military, too, go back to the so-called socialist period of Egypt. Nasser and Tantawi, like Mubarak, was also did his military training in the Soviet Union. And socialism in Egypt never meant the kind of Russian Marxist type socialism. In Egypt, socialism has always meant more of a notion of social justice, sort of distributive justice, if you will, so that the little guy, the average family, can have a decent standard of living, that there's equal opportunity, so that even if you're a farmer or a taxi driver, your kids have a shot at going to college, that sort of thing. So there is so the word there has a much, much more positive connotation than it does in the U.S., and this is seen as part of the – if you look at the Constitution, in fact, that's in place, there's an awful lot of discussion of socialism and helping people out and this sort of thing. So you can democratize – on the political side, if you want to think in terms of separate political and economic spheres, while sort of moving much more slowly or just sort of holding the line on economic reform for the time being. I think most economists, and even those economists who are sympathetic with the idea of social justice and helping up little people, would say that there do need to be further structural reforms in the economy to help the country get going and to deal with this problem of unemployment. But there's disagreement as to what exactly needs to be done and how quickly and so forth.
We are at our midpoint. Our guest is Ken Cuno. He's professor of history at University of Illinois and spends a lot of his time following contemporary politics in Egypt. And is here to talk with us about Egypt and what has happened here over the last couple of weeks. Going back to the 11th, the longtime president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, stepped down, was forced out by about 3 weeks of popular protest. The military took over. There is the promise that there will be elections, that they will set aside the 30-year-old emergency law, that there will be a rewrite of the Constitution. That remains to be seen how all that will play out, and we're talking a little bit about what at this point can be said, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm wondering what one might say about the immediate future here for Mr. Mubarak. He, his son, people who are in their circle have been pushed aside. Mm-hmm. Their financial assets have been frozen. And one wonders what exactly is going to happen to them. Can you even speculate on what will happen to them?
I gather that President Mubarak, former President Mubarak, is still on Egyptian soil. So conceivably, he could face charges. I don't detect any great rush to do that. What they're doing now, and this is one of the areas of movement, is prosecutors are looking into the activities of the circles around the Mubarak family, not so much the family itself, but and also some of the ministers of government. So some of the cashiered, some of the ministers who were fired after the first week of protests were also detained and told not to leave the country, including the Minister of Interior, whose name escapes me at the moment. But he, because there are allegations that he ordered ordered the police to actually fire with live ammunition on the demonstrators. That sort of thing. I think some of the other former ministers, too, are now being looked into because of their charges of corruption against them, and their assets have been frozen. The Mubarak family's assets, the Egyptians have asked various governments to freeze the assets of the Mubarak family, but it hasn't been done everywhere. So I'm not really sure what's – I think that's a legalistic process, country by country. But – If it's anything like what happened after President Sadat was assassinated, there also was he was extremely unpopular before the assassination, and he might well have been shoved aside had he not been killed by the extremists. And there was an investigation of, I think, his brother, if I'm not mistaken, and some other people around him, but there seems to be a reluctance to go after the family itself. And actually, Suzanne Mubarak, the former first lady, even though a lot of people have said that she's rather authoritarian or in her own way, seems not to have been tainted by this, at least in the public mind, so much. Whereas President Sadat's wife, Jihan, people were utterly convinced that she was part of the corruption, money corruption, back in 1980-81. Whether that was true or not, I have no idea. Whereas Mrs. Mubarak is seen as somebody who, well, she did something to promote libraries and education. She did something, and she probably did have something, actually, with to do with advancing women's rights during the Mubarak presidency. That's one of the bright spots, I guess you could say, of the regime.
What now of the is there any future for the National Democratic Party, the previously ruling party?
Conceivably. Now, I haven't, of course, I'm not a close student of their operations. It was not a real party in the true sense. Under the regime, it was more a place where potential kleptocrats would sort of try to bandwagon on to the regime so they could get their advantages. But it's possible that the NDP could evolve if they've got a structure that is worth keeping, and if there actually is a core group of people that have some interests in common, they might evolve in the way that the former communist parties have done in Eastern Europe and Russia. Just remains to be seen. I think a name change is probably in the offing. Because you want to rebrand yourself. You don't want to be too associated with the old days. But it wouldn't surprise me if they survived in some form.
You know, going back to talking about the military for a little bit, I think in the coverage of the demonstrations, when things first got going, part of the narrative was that the military had chosen to stand back, not take sides. There were instances where we were being told that perhaps the military was actually trying to provide some kind of buffer between the anti-Mubarak people and the pro-Mubarak people. But I think at some point it became the obvious that the military had been involved, likely had been involved in picking up people and was implicated in some disappearances of people and also in some torture. I think there still are questions about are the military holding people? Were there people who might have died in military custody? So the question is, well, is there going to be some accountability there? And you wonder, well, if the military is actually running the government, it seems maybe not very likely that there would. Will there be some pressing by the people who were involved in driving Mubarak from power for some accountability of the military to people that they picked up and held?
So far, there's only been a repetition of the demand for the release of political prisoners. And I don't know how many alleged political prisoners there are still unreleased. But an accounting of the military's activities, this may, and these activities which have been reported may actually reflect a split between junior officers and senior officers, junior officers plus rank and file versus senior officers, or maybe different factions within the officer corps. It's hard to say. But I think the time to expect people or the government to look into that or to begin to look into that would be after the transition, after elections and the formation of a new government that has some sort of constitutional legitimacy. And that's going to be a tricky one, because if the abuses are pretty widespread, or if a lot of people are potentially implicated in that, well, then you have this new, you would have a situation of the new fledgling government and presumably a minister of justice coming out of the civilian background, or a prosecutor coming from a civilian background, taking on the military potentially, or investigating the military. And that could be a tricky situation. So my at this point, all I can say is that this has been reported, and this doesn't seem to be a number one or even a number five issue on the agenda of the democracy protesters. They seem to be taking things at a measured pace.
We have a caller to talk with, and maybe I'll just quickly give the phone numbers if some other folks would like to call in with questions. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. The caller is here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Just to start, one thing that doesn't get reported as much is the union activism that's led up to this, the student movement that sort of did a lot of the organizing. Their name is from April 5th, which was the beginning of a strike that was, if I'm understanding correctly, was mainly sort of women garment workers. And so, and there had been a lot of this activism. Things had been, the monolith was already being undermined. But so just in the point of that being missed a lot in the regular coverage, I didn't hear it from the very top, but there was supposed to be another guest. I hope he'll be on another time, because he had a great brief when I was looking at his page. But one thing, obviously, the U.S. role hasn't been treated much in the Israeli connection. I learned some things in the process of this that I hadn't known before, which one was that the Camp David Accords actually had a numerical limitation on the size of the Egyptian army. I didn't really realize that was included, as well as out of the Sinai, et cetera.
That's just with demilitarization of the Sinai only. It doesn't place a limit on the total number of troops in Egypt. And
I see.
Sinai was divided into three zones from the Suez Canal over to the Israeli border. And progressively, as you move toward Israel, the limitations on troops and weaponry get more and more stringent. And the reason that came out in the news is because of Bedouin uprisings in the Sinai, in the area of Arish, which is in that middle zone. The Israelis, in consultation with the Egyptians, gave their go-ahead for the Egyptians to move additional troops into that area, setting aside the terms of the treaty temporarily, at least, in order to deal with that uprising. So that's what that was about.
Well, there's Illinois and also Connecticut National Guard that moved there recently. Is this part of a regular rotation in, or is this exceptional?
National Guard in the Sinai?
Yeah.
I don't think that's correct. It's been a long time since I've looked at this, but there was a debate back in at the time of the signing of the treaty, because it called for an international force to be positioned there as observers or as a tripwire, if you will. And the Congress didn't want to have U.S. military participating in that force. So the way it was finessed was that a private contractor hired, basically an American private contractor has troops over there, as I understand it, and they're under the U.N. flag, which is something that doesn't bother the Congress, but putting American troops under the U.N. flag would bother the Congress. So this is one of these diplomatic sort of jerry-rigged things.
There has been guards going to Egypt, though. I know that I should have Googled that. But anyway, I'll look at that later. But
well, we do have a military presence there. We have a military mission in Egypt. But that's military to military, and it doesn't have to do with the Sinai.
Okay. The explosion that interrupted this pipeline was the other thing. And talking to some Arab friends about that, I found out that they have a grievance, and I don't know if this came out of the Camp David Accords, but apparently Israel buys gas from Egypt or at least that comes through Egypt,
yeah.
That is a third of the cost of the international price. I hadn't heard anything about this before, and it seemed to be a grievance with the people I was talking to. The World Bank goes around and tells people that they should be buying market prices if they're in Ukraine, but haven't heard any discussion of this. I don't know if you have any insight on that.
Well, I don't know about the price, per se. The agreement to supply gas to Israel in the building of the pipeline, that was controversial when it was done some years back. I think it goes back more than 10 years. And at the same time, there was another proposal to build a pipeline to supply water to Israel as well, because they were extending a canal pipeline from the Nile to El Arish in the north, which is an area that needs more water. And the symbolism of the sacred waters of the Nile being provided to Israel was just too much. So in a sense, I don't know if this was a red herring or not, but so the government never proceeded on the water, but they did build the pipeline. Egypt has huge reserves of natural gas in the western desert and under the delta that they discovered and developed going back about 20 years, more than 20 years. And so the gas pipeline is unpopular. That's probably why it was hit. It's logical that the Israelis would negotiate a price of a stable price, and then free market international prices move up and down. But beyond that, I certainly can't verify that it's as low as you suggested it is.
Well, there's a concept of odious debt, which is if you have a dictator that makes deals that are, the country that
right.
is infringed upon can be. The U.S. has backed this, not recently, but in 1898, vis-a-vis the Spanish. But it seems to me that if you have a dictator who negotiates a deal, that should be abrogated too. And it sort of brings up the whole idea of how much kind of revisiting of these kind of things will go ahead now, and how much won't.
I think that one will be the pipeline in particular will be revisited. The price, if the price is too low, or the supply of gas in and of itself, not by this transitional government necessarily, because they've signaled to the Americans and the rest of the world that with regard to foreign policy, there will be no changes under this Supreme Military Council. But once you have a government that's been elected, and presuming that the government is a fairly representative government and we can expect some populism in the politics, it wouldn't surprise me if the supply of gas to Israel was renegotiated or stopped entirely as maybe a gesture to public opinion. But you know, so that would be the easiest one for them to do.
But just one of the things certainly I'm a lot of people have asked, and I'm sure that the government in Israel is thinking about this, is how may the policy of Egypt toward Israel change if we have a change of government? Would it be expected to change much?
I think it would change somewhat. But again, it partly depends upon how this process of transition to a new regime works out and how the new regime is actually composed of, I mean, how it's constructed. Mm-hmm. The close cooperation on security, of course, is security, intelligence to intelligence and military to military. And it's very much in Egypt's interest to maintain the peace treaty and to maintain correct relations with Israel, correct in the diplomatic sense that you abide by the treaty and you do the right things. In addition to the possible ending or changing of this relationship with supply of gas. The other area where I think a more representative populist government would make changes would be in the relationship with Gaza, opening the border perhaps to allow some sort of normal movement back and forth. Maybe we should put normal in quotation marks. I don't know. That is a very tricky proposition, of course, politically and diplomatically. But I think that most Egyptians regard the Gaza situation in human rights terms rather than in terms of a security risk. Not that the Egyptians would simply do this on their, you know, carte blanche. They would probably want to lean on Hamas a little bit as a quid pro quo to make sure that they behave themselves. If they're capable of doing that.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Ken Cuno. He's a professor of history at the University of Illinois. We're talking about Egypt. As the caller mentioned, we also had been planning on having Asif Bayat here on the program as well. He is a professor of sociology and Middle East studies at U of I, has done a lot of work on social movements in this part of the world. And we do intend to have him on the program. We hope maybe sometime within the next couple of weeks we could have him on. I think, indeed, he would have some interesting things to say as well. So we have another caller here. We'll get to them, and they're in LaSalle County, and line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was under the impression that there were American troops in the Sinai as blue hats.
That's correct.
Under the auspices of the United Nations.
That's correct, but they're not American military personnel. They are private contractors, as I understand it.
Private contractors again.
Yeah.
Oh God. And my question is now that these rogues, the Gaddafi family and the Mubarak family, are being rounded up, is the United States government? This is speculative, of course. Are we going to do anything to see to it that they're not going to be able to run away with all the loot that they've stolen and pilfered? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that the response of Hillary Clinton would be that it's up to the legal government in Egypt and what may eventually become a legal government in Libya to pursue these issues. We can, you know, from this end, cooperate. But really, as we were mentioning earlier in this discussion, that the Egyptians are looking into the allegedly corrupt circles around Mubarak, and there have been freezes on their assets in various parts of the world, and that sort of thing is proceeding. But it isn't necessarily up to us, and I don't think other governments, certainly I don't think the Arab governments or the Arab revolutionaries expect the Americans to lead the charge in that. That would be another sort of interference.
Yeah. You know, you talked a little bit earlier about some of the recent changes in the cabinet that mm-hmm. have taken place, and the fact that number of new people have been brought in, and some of them are people that were involved in parties other than what had been the official ruling party, the NDP, even though these were parties that had cooperative relationship with the government. So, if you were going to call them opposition parties, maybe you'd have to put that in quotes. The thing that people keep asking about over and over and over again is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is officially banned. But I think my understanding is if it was allowed to be a party, it might be the biggest opposition party, or at least it would be considerable. I mean, maybe in numbers would be small, but compared to others, it would be significant. Early on in the protest, it seemed that the Muslim Brotherhood was kind of hanging back. They didn't want to get involved. And in fact, I think they even said at one point, well, even if there were elections, we would not run a candidate, which actually they couldn't because at that point anyway, mm-hmm. because they were mm-hmm. officially banned. But it seems like everybody keeps coming back to this question about what sort of role might they play in the future politics of the country, and then what that would mean for the country, and particularly for its foreign relations. Mm-hmm. What can you say about the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, first of all, it's not a monolith. Broadly speaking, the Brotherhood has two kind of orientations, an old guard and sort of a younger, or you might call them, actually they're more middle-aged than young. The old guard, in a sense, can remember the old days of the 1950s and the repression under Nasser, and perhaps some of them could even remember as far back as the 1940s and the leadership of the founder, Hassan al-Banna. And their orientation seems to be more toward proselytizing and doing what they've always done best, proselytizing, charity work, this sort of thing, trying to convert Muslims to real Muslims according to their criteria. This middle-aged group, though, are the ones who've led the effort to engage in politics going back to the middle 1980s and adopting a very gradualist approach. And one of the interesting things is that even though the degree to which the opposition parties and also the Muslim Brotherhood members who were elected to parliament, and by the way, they ran as independents, which is how a non-party could actually get members in. They ran at one point. They ran under the banner of one of the one or another of the political parties. But then, once when the law was amended to allow independents to run, and we should talk about the electoral law, by the way, then they were able to elect members who were known as Brotherhood, but technically they were independents. Once you're in a process and you have to engage and you have to make common cause with other opposition, including secular opposition, suddenly you're learning political arts and you're learning to prioritize and as any member of the city council or Congress could tell you, you can't stick to pure principle if you want to get anything done. And so this is there's been an educational process, I think, with this middle-aged, more engaged group. And the spokespeople that you hear making these statements are this letter group. So they're the ones who said no, and they're very media savvy. We're not going to run somebody for president. Back in 2005, when the Bush administration, with its democracy agenda, freedom agenda, had pressured the Egyptians to open up the political system to make it a tad more free and fair, the Brotherhood deliberately chose to run candidates in a minority of districts so that there was no possibility that they could win a majority in the parliament. That was their signal to the regime as well as to the Americans and Europeans, like, hey, we want to participate, but we don't want to be perceived as a threat. And the reason they did that, it was reported at the time, is they were thinking of Algeria and what happened in Algeria in 1991 and 92 when the Algerian Islamic Front was poised to win the second round of elections and the military, with the backing of the U.S. and France, moved in and squelched the elections, and there was a terrible civil war after that. They didn't want that. They wanted to survive. And hence the gradualist and very cautious policy that they're still following. So now, yes, they're talking about forming a political party. They've said in the last couple of weeks, okay, we're going to form a political party to contest elections whenever these elections happen. In the meantime, something very interesting has happened, and that is a more, I guess you could call them a more liberal dissident group that split off in a small number of individuals in the mid-1990s. Have got a party now, and this is the so-called Wasat Party, or the Center Party, which declared itself in 1996, and it only became legalized this past week, a few days ago, through an Egyptian Cairo court action. So this is the so-called Center Party, or Wasat Party. It includes some of its leadership, former Muslim Brotherhood members who were chafing under the stodgy rule of the old guard. And their vision is to have an Egypt for everyone. So they have Coptic Christian members. They have also taken the position in their agenda that it's okay to have a Christian head of state, elected president. That's okay with them. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure if they actually qualify as Islamists anymore. I think the Islamism is kind of a moral imperative, maybe an ethical imperative, a little bit like Christian democracy in Europe. I'm just not quite sure about that. Most of the over 20 political parties in Egypt, by the way, that have formed since the multi-party system was put in place in the late 70s have been formed against the wishes of the government. The current law, and this is where amending the Constitution is nice, but current statute law also has to be changed, because current law says that to form a legal political party, you've got to get approval by a certain committee that's in the Ministry of God knows what. And they routinely say no. You don't meet the qualifications to have a legal political party. So the Wasat Party had to wait 15 years to get legalized. And since 1979, every new political party to be legalized, it's been through lawsuits in the courts overturning these administrative decisions of the government. So it's it'd be a little bit like if President Obama said, right, nobody can be on the ballot, nobody can form a political party unless my administration says you're okay. And here's the ridiculous criteria we're going to use.
Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time. I'll ask a question that's not fair to ask because there's really enough time to answer it. But I think about the things that people who were involved in these protests said about how they felt it changed them. It changed the way they thought about their country. Do you think that this is likely to really change Egyptian society at some sort of fundamental level?
It has the potential if things keep moving forward, if momentum is retained, and if the authoritarians don't come back in and create a kind of a halfway situation. I mean, I hope that Egypt doesn't. I don't think Egypt will become Belarus, but I hope they become more like, say, Slovenia or something like that, because the kinds of changes we, especially for us old Egyptian hands, the kind of changes we saw were people voluntarily cleaning up the Tahrir Square and signs going up saying this is now your country. In all the years I'd been going to Egypt, I used to wonder, because when I was a kid, we had these television campaigns, don't litter, the message was the country belongs to you. So if you're littering, you're messing up your own property, right? And so to give people a sense of ownership, of responsibility, that wasn't there. It's there now, or at least that seemed to be part of the spirit of the revolution. So if they can continue this momentum towards something more democratic with people buying in, participatory democracy, then you will also have a greater sense of responsibility toward one's fellow citizens. One can hope for that.
Well, I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk again, but for now, we want to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ken Cunon, he's professor of history here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.